London Calling, David here, and this is another of our Meet Your Guide interviews. This is one of our new signings. This is the distinguished music critic, or he was a music critic, Rick Jones. So, Rick.
Hi, David.
Hello, good morning. Tell us about your start in life, Rick. Where did you grow up and all of that? And
okay, I'm a Londoner.
You're a Londoner.
South good London. Stuff. Born in Lewisham, which is quite close to the centre. And then when aged 5 or 6, my parents moved to the suburbs of London. So I grew up on the outer perimeter.
Uh-huh.
I went to school at a place called Whitgift School in Croydon, which is what we term a public school, although in another definition it's a private school. And it's a school that has a great history. Archbishop John Whitgift was Archbishop of Canterbury during Queen Elizabeth I's time, so it's 500 years of history in this place in Croydon. Beautiful place with a courtyard and peacocks that crowed and interrupted lessons. It was fun as well. I went to the University of East Anglia for my A-levels. I did languages, French, uh-huh, German, and music. Languages and music. But at university, languages is what I took. European literature at the University of East Anglia.
Fantastic.
I studied under a professor who became world famous as an author, W.G. Sebald. We knew him as Max Sebald, but W.G. Sebald is his writing name. And he wrote 4 books, The Emigrants, The Oscar Wunderton, The Rings of Saturn. That's what he first became famous for. It's travels through the mind and through geography. So The Rings of Saturn is a walk he took through East Anglia and and then wrote about it in historic and contemporary terms. And then he wrote Vertigo, and then finally Austerlitz. And then he died in a car crash on the outskirts of, on the Ring Road in Norwich, which was his university town. He lived in England ever since he was a student himself, although he always only wrote in German. So German was my subject and degree, but in the context of literature, and music as a minor degree.
Uh-huh.
When I left the university, I did a further degree at the Royal College of Music as, uh-huh, a lute player and singer. So after university, I then sort of concentrated on a music degree, on a music qualification, and that's for a while. I became a semi-professional singer around town, deputising at Westminster Abbey and St Paul's Cathedral. Doing a few recordings, that sort of thing, with groups mainly.
Uh-huh.
Although I did develop this strand as a lute player and singer with a costume, and managed to get a few sort of cabaret bookings at rather strange places sometimes. I used to busk a lot on the continent, and I got invited to perform at a nightclub in Pforzheim in West Germany.
Did you really? So was the music thing, did that get started when you were a child then? You love music right from the time?
Yeah,
you were...
I was a boy chorister, not in a cathedral, but a parish church, but it was a good, uh-huh, one. The choir master at the time was one of the first Benjamin Britten conductors. He had Trinity Boys was his choir. That was a different choir to the one he trained me at. But they became the recording stars of Benjamin Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream, another Shakespeare connection. So he was a leading figure in his own right too. And, uh-huh, then when I was at university, I also sang at the Cathedral Choir in Norwich.
Uh-huh.
And I got a little house there too as part of it. It was a charming existence I had as a student.
Oh, very nice.
Since then I sang, well, as I said, I deputised around London. And then I became a full-time member of the Southwark Cathedral Choir.
Uh-huh.
Southwark is a part of London, South London. And in fact, it's the Shakespeare part of town. That's where the original Globe, Rose, Swan, theatres were, the Shakespeare theatres, all in this borough of Southwark. And Southwark Cathedral, William Shakespeare knew.
Sure.
In his time, it was called St. Saviour's Church, but it's the same building, more or less.
That's right.
So, yeah. I've been associated with music, either writing about it or performing about it, ever since I was an unbroken voice boy, treble.
So when you were a little kid, did you were you thinking career-wise in terms of music?
I thought I'd be a great performer. I thought I'd be one of the leading stars of the classical music stage.
You still might be, Rick. Yeah.
But I mean, I maybe temperament is what did it for me, really. You have to have a certain mindset. You mustn't be too frivolous. You know, you've got to be very serious as about your ambitions and your prospects. And perhaps I never really had that. And so I found my niche writing about it, and that's what I did for 20 years. I was 10 years the music critic of the Evening Standard. That was the second half, and then 10 years before that as a sort of freelance. Well, no, I suppose the 10 years at the Evening Standard was in the middle, because then I had a freelance period after that.
I'm just interested. I mean, this is, I'm sure, the standard ignorant question. How do critics work? I mean, are you actually how do they work? Are you actually jotting stuff down during a performance? And
yes.
How do you avoid annoying the person who's sitting next to you? And you've got a little pen with a light on it and all of that.
I don't have a little pen with a light on it.
Okay.
Well, so on that specific point, the opera house is dark. Yeah. So then you're scribbling in the dark. But most concert halls are light enough. In the concert world, live music, you can see what you're writing. But in any case, the tradition here, at least, has always been to provide two seats for the critic, so he can bring a guest or she. And so that you know, sitting next to someone who's annoying you it doesn't really arise, and you can either fill that seat or not. So that also doesn't come into question. But some critics won't write anything. They'll just, you know, take it all in and then spew it out as a long piece at the end of it. Depends how much you have to write as well. You know, if it's a very short 250-word piece, some are, then you don't need to write too many notes. It's going to be just a general impression. If it's a long piece, then you're going to have to make a few notes, yeah.
Are you enjoying it, knowing that you're going to have to turn out some words about it?
Are you enjoying the performance? Well, if the performance is enjoyable, then you do. That's no question. But probably, you know, 60% of what I went to was, you know, halfway, or there were things to say about it. Rather than it being, you know, an all-out, this is a five-star performance, go and hear it. Enjoying it. Will you enjoy the job? I mean, I did love writing about music. And it was fun if it was something embarrassing, bad, because then you'd have fun writing about it, which might sound rather cruel, and it was, actually. It's fun to write something, you know, amusing about a performance, taking it down, but then the reaction of the performers, you regret in the end, because it's not nice to make people unhappy. But you don't really think about that at the time. I'm glad not to be a critic anymore for those reasons. I am in the critical world in that I'm still I'm the secretary of the critic circle. I don't criticize anymore. All my writing is now confined to the world of guiding and writing scripts for performance, for tours.
Did you get to know the musicians sometimes, some of the musicians. And
sometimes I did, and I would interview musicians. So the other side of the criticism is writing about artists and their performances.
Uh-huh.
So I interviewed quite a few people, and you interview people who you like.
Uh-huh.
So you like, you know, you've seen them, you like their work, and you decide you'd like to interview them. So
yeah.
I did get to know a few people.
Yeah.
I had one altercation with a performer. I don't know if you remember the violinist Vanessa May.
No, I don't.
No.
Go on, tell the story, though.
She was very heavily promoted by her mother. She was a Korean girl, violinist, pretty good, but it was all sort of puff and rather less substance. And she did a tour of the country, which I described as being like limping like a three-legged dog onto the stage. And they took great exception to this and decided to... They paid for half a page in the Times to denounce my criticism of, uh-huh. of her. And at the time, it was a bit of a cause célèbre, you know, it made a uh-huh. bit of a smell around the place. Some for and some against, you know, the critic who takes a pot shot at a hard working artist, or, you know, on the other side, well done for criticizing someone who needed to be criticized.
Yeah, sure. Now, you're a musician yourself and a performer, and then you became a critic. I'm sure there must be theater reviewers who couldn't act to save themselves. Would that ever be the case in music criticism, that there are people who
only listen and I know critics who can't sing. That's not uh-huh. so unusual.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know whether those who can't sing cannot also play a musical instrument.
Uh-huh.
I think there are people... Probably most of the critics know their way around a score.
Uh-huh.
This is classical music critics. I mean, music is such a difficult area in some ways. It's the only one of the arts which has not yet managed to fuse the popular and the classical forms. So, you know, in literature, for instance, the pop writing, if there is such a thing, but contemporary writing has managed easily to sit alongside the works of Dickens or Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
And the same in art. You know, the pop world of Andy Warhol is now criticized by the same people who criticize the works of Vermeer.
Uh-huh.
But in music, that has not happened.
That's
and it's
very
the only, see, in the critics' circle, for instance, it's the only one of the disciplines which doesn't yet have a pop side to it.
Uh-huh.
The music section is only made up of classical music critics.
They're
trying to change that now by uh-huh. you know, getting jazz critics involved and pop ones. But I got onto that because in that world, well, not even Paul McCartney can't read music. He has
That's
confessed.
Right.
He don't, yeah. I mean, he can to a little bit, but he's never trained himself to read the dots.
Uh-huh.
So it's by ear or reading guitar chords.
Uh-huh.
Whereas obviously it's an essential thing for a classical violinist. You have, that's what your bread and butter is, reading the notes. You
uh-huh.
know. That's, and choristers, choir people too, you know, you're given a piece of music, you have one rehearsal, you're expected it to be able to perform it
yeah.
from the sheet music.
I had a revelatory moment when I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin. I think it was the Chicago Symphony Orchestra or something like that. They came to Madison, Wisconsin, and I found myself seated opposite one, and I knew nothing, and I still know nothing about music. And I asked him about it, and he said, "Look, I read music the way you read the newspaper."
Yeah.
You know, it's just second nature to him, is what That's he was right. saying.
Yeah, it is. It's a language as
yes.
well. It's, you know, it's a much broader and more expressive language than words, but it's a language nonetheless. And it's a truly international language too, you know. We there isn't a language problem in a concert hall.
Yeah,
Germans, Japanese, Chinese, they can all come to the same place and experience the same things. It's that is a great attribute of music.
Did you ever, and one more question, did you ever review pop music at all, rock concert?
No, but I did play in a band when I was at university. I was a keyboard player. Jack Plug and the Inputs, we were called.
Yeah.
And the lead singer of that band was Arthur Smith, who is now quite a well-known comedian, mostly radio stuff. But he and I have formed a double partnership, a duo, once a year on Shakespeare's birthday. We have given a performance since the year 2000 relating to some facet of Shakespeare's life, but mostly connected with Southwark Cathedral. So, I mean, we're sort of now talking in very relevant terms about the immediate present, because I'm doing this series of Shakespeare virtual tours on Mondays, which are revisiting the lectures, the illustrated talks that we gave once a year from the year 2000. So every Monday for the next 2 months, I'm redoing them.
And those are
without
all on
him, actually, but he was the original deliverer of the speeches. It's just me this time, honestly.
And those are all on www.walks.com, is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. Rick, is this
every Monday at 7 p.m.
So
and
this is the
so we started last Monday, and that was Shakespeare and and I've forgotten already. What was it? It was Shakespeare and Medicine. And that was the story of John Hall, who was Shakespeare's son-in-law. Shakespeare's daughter, Susanna, married the number one, well, he was the only doctor in Stratford-upon-Avon, Dr. John Hall. And it was the story of his life, where he studied, what he studied, and what his practice was like in the 1600s, Shakespeare's time. Next Monday is the story of a Shakespearean feminist. This is Monday the 19th of April. A woman called Elizabeth Newcomen, who was Shakespeare's milkmaid. She ran a dairy. She was a milkmaid from the age of about 7 or 8, carrying pails of milk, milking cows in Southwark. And she eventually ran the dairy herself, so she became a businesswoman, and it was a big success. She married a man called Newcomen, so Newcomen was her married name. He died. She remained single and took over his business affairs. And so she became a very independent and outspoken woman. She owned a lot of property around Southwark. She started a school for girls at that time, which was also quite unusual. And then the legacy she left in her will was to support women, poor women in their age, at old age. And that became a charity which still exists. And the school she founded, Newcomen Girls' School, lasted until the 1960s. It was then closed down, but the fund is still very wealthy, and the Newcomen Foundation is still supporting women. So it's her story next Monday.
Rick,
and then
I
on Shakespeare's birthday, I'm giving the first live open-air walking tour since the pandemic began for me.
Yeah,
this is we've had a relaxation of the lockdown rules in the last couple of weeks, and now walking tours are permitted once again with certain restrictions. There can't be more than a certain number of people. I think we're still going by the rule of six, which, as I understand it, is not just six people. It could be six little groups of people who are within their own bubbles. But
that's right.
I think that's the way it works.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I shall be, I hope, leading a group of people on a Shakespeare walk on Shakespeare's birthday through the streets of London, looking at places relevant to Shakespeare's time. We start at Moorgate Tube. Do you want? Shall I go on or?
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. I want to butt in for a second and say, you know, if Mary were here, she would be saying to me, "Stop gaping, David. You look like a goldfish." Now, the reason my mouth is hanging open is, you know, I know something about Shakespeare. I lectured in Shakespeare for 33 years, but I've never heard of this milkmaid. Where in the world did all that come about from? How did you find out about her?
Well, she has a memorial in Southwark Cathedral, and the dates... I've picked people whose dates must have coincided with Shakespeare. Uh-huh. I have no proof that she ever met Shakespeare. She's born in 1605 when Shakespeare was 42 years old. Uh-huh. So it's possible, it's plausible, it's even likely that he did see her because she would have taken pails of milk around the streets of Southwark.
And Southwark was a small place, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's that bit of London which is the south side of London Bridge. You have Borough High Street, and it became a suburb. It was not called London. London was only on the north side. It was a separate place from London, in a sense, although people in Southwark tended to be rather sort of outcast individuals. It was a place of brothels, as you must know, and gaming, bear pits. That was entertainment London of a seedy nature on the south side of the river. So well-to-do people would come across in boats each evening, ferry boats. You either took the bridge or you came by a boat, and would populate the brothels, the stews, as they were called, along Bankside in Southwark. And that's where these theatres were. And that's the environment that this woman, Elizabeth Newcomen, or Elizabeth Lant is what her name was. She was, her grandfather, both her grandfathers on her mother's and father's side were Lord Mayors of Exeter. So her family had come originally from the southwest of the country.
Any connection with Lant Street?
Lant Street is there now, yeah.
Yeah, any connection there?
Yes. Her father, who was William Lant, he was a younger son of the Lord Mayor of Exeter. So not having an inheritance, he had to go off and find his own fortune somewhere else. So he came to London. He bought a plot of land, which is now where Lant Street is. And then if you cross Borough High Street and go to there's Newcomen Street. And if you go down Newcomen Street, that's named after her, the end of Newcomen Street is Bowling Green Place. And that's where the dairy was. That's where the Lants had their dairy. And that's where she learnt the business. She grew up as a, you know, running the parlour. Newcomen Street at that time was called King Street. It only took the new name Newcomen Street later, when she'd become famous and her legacy had become into its own.
And I think there's a Dickens connection.
There is the King's Pub there. So King Street, and then the King's Head Arms, which is the King's Head Pub, is along there.
And I think there's a Dickens connection with Lant Street, if I remember correctly, if I remember my Pickwick papers.
There's a big Dickens connection. It's Little Dorrit all around there and the Marshalsea Prison. The Marshalsea Prison is where his father was imprisoned in the early part of his career. And in fact, Dickens lived in Lant Street too. He hasn't got a plaque, but I noticed yesterday when I was looking at Lant Street that he was one of the previous residents there when he was young, when the father was in the prison.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's go back to the others that you're doing, but let me ask you, this is the first few months we've been together with you. Is there any chance that this could become an annual thing, these virtual tours in April, these Shakespeare Connected virtual tours?
Let's do it. I'm happy to keep doing them, yes.
Okay, so where did we get to?
The third one along is about the Marlowe conspiracy. And actually, that's the one that I began with in 2000. There is a statue of Shakespeare in Leicester Square. You know?
I certainly do know it. Yep.
Yeah. And well, at the time, it had no inscription. It didn't say this is William Shakespeare. Everyone just understood it to be William Shakespeare. But on its scroll, there is a quote. And the quote is, there is no darkness but ignorance. And I hunted everywhere for that quote, and I could not find it. I could not know where could it be. In my Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, there are 100 pages of Shakespeare quotes in it, and it's not there. So that puzzled me. But there is a quote by Marlowe that is, there is no sin but ignorance. It's the same line, but for one word. There is no ignorance but darkness. There is no sin but darkness. There is no sin but ignorance. There is no sin but ignorance. That's the quote from Marlowe. It's in The Jew of Malta. And so I was interested by this confusion between William Shakespeare and Marlowe. So perhaps the statue in Leicester Square is in a sense Marlowe, or maybe it's an everyman playwright. It is. We know it's Shakespeare in a sense because it's an exact copy of the Shakespeare Memorial in Westminster Abbey in Poets' Corner. But in Westminster Abbey, the quote on the scroll is the lines from The Tempest: "The cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples shall dissolve." So that's clearly Shakespeare. In fact, I have the internet, because the internet can scroll through the entire works of Shakespeare in a second. I have found it now, and it comes from Twelfth Night, although it's a scene which is often omitted because it doesn't seem to be particularly relevant. But "there is no ignorance but darkness" is a quote by Shakespeare, but it is obviously clearly influenced by this line from Marlowe, and so the two are connected, Shakespeare and Marlowe. And then the interesting things about Marlowe's life are that he is a direct contemporary of William Shakespeare. They're both born in 1564, so they're exactly the same age. And yet Marlowe had already written three or four masterpieces before Shakespeare had even written one, Shakespeare's writing career starts relatively late. He's aged 29 before he writes Titus Andronicus, I think is supposed to be the first one, in 1592. And that's the year that Marlowe is murdered, or 1593. So Marlowe dies, supposedly. Shakespeare arrives. And the theory by some people is that Marlowe is the author of Shakespeare's plays, which comes from this. And there was always doubt about Marlowe's death, as you probably know. Was he murdered? You know, a hurried act, burial in Deptford. He was supposed to have been knifed to death in a pub in Deptford, southeast London.
In the eye, I think. Was he knifed in the eye?
Yes, that's right. But there is enough doubt about it, even for Westminster Abbey, to put a question mark by his date of death.
Interesting.
In the stained glass window where he has a memorial. Yeah. They put him in 1993. That was when the Marlowe Memorial was introduced, 400 years after he died. Because Marlowe was always he was an atheist at a time when atheism was punishable by death.
And hasn't it been suggested that he was what they probably wouldn't have used this exact phrase, but a sexual deviant?
As well.
Yes.
Well, yeah. He claimed that, I mean, blasphemy, he claimed that Jesus and John were bedfellows.
Fantastic.
You know, that's right back then in 1590. You can't get more blasphemous than that. Even today, that would make people blanch. I've just said it, but, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, Marlowe was a very interesting character. I think the evidence against it, him, Marlowe writing the plays, is that the plays of Marlowe are so rigidly poetic.
Uh-huh.
The iambic pentameter, the poetic form, is it's perfect. It hardly ever deviates at all.
Marlowe's mighty line.
Yes, Marlowe's mighty line, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And but Shakespeare varies a lot. Sometimes uh-huh. there's prose, sometimes there's rhyme, sometimes there is iambic pentameter is more or less the basis for the whole thing, uh-huh. but Shakespeare is very varied. And Shakespeare contains some 200 songs. Every few scenes in most of the plays, there is an opportunity for another song to keep the crowd entertained, to keep people interested, which that doesn't happen in the other plays. You know, you don't get songs through Marlowe. There may have been songs at the time, but in Shakespeare, they're written in.
Yeah.
So there are big differences. And I think, you know, it on balance, I'm not a favour of... I'm not... a fan of this particular Marlowe theory. I think the plays by Shakespeare, if there is any doubt as to the authorship, it's really that they were collaborations more than the effort of one man,
mm-hmm.
especially mm-hmm. as Shakespeare was a member of a company, and so he was also an actor, and so would have been taking part in rehearsals. Perhaps he was the man at the end of the day who wrote down the lines that had been improvised and rehearsed. But I think we know that there was a lot of collaboration in them,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps that had come from rehearsal.
There's a lot of collaboration in the world of guiding. But remind me, what's the line? Is it a small reckoning in a Deptford tavern? What was that line about?
That's right. Marlowe?
Is that right?
It's something about a reckoning. I can't remember the entire quote, but yeah.
The word reckoning.
A small reckoning, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That led, according to the story, to him being attacked and stabbed to death.
Yes.
So
he was supposed to have been a spy. He was a spy, we know
that's
that.
That's right.
And he mixed in very high circles.
Uh-huh.
His sponsor was Walsingham, who was Elizabeth's spy master. And so the theory is that he managed to help him escape, Walsingham, uh-huh. Marlowe. It's an American's theory. I can't remember the name of the chap who wrote the book originally that I read about the whole Marlowe thing.
Yeah.
And
he was 29 years old, is that right? When his life...
Yeah, 1593.
I mean, he packed a lot... He packed a lot of living into 3 decades, didn't he?
Marlowe did, yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Incredible.
Yeah.
And yet Shakespeare has done nothing up until that time. He's written a little bit of poetry, but his career starts in that year, 1592, London. That's when he arrives. And then the 1590s are the history plays.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this sense of the Shakespeare Company, the King, the Chamberlain's Men, as they were called, presenting history to Londoners. So it's like the History Channel, you know, in an entertaining way.
Mm-hmm.
People learning their own history from the dramas on the stage.
That's well put.
And then, largely speaking, once Elizabeth's reign comes to an end and James takes over, 1603, then you get the great... tragedies and comedies, so it's not completely like that. There are, you know, some. I think Twelfth Night is 1600 for the first time, which is still in Elizabeth's reign.
Uh-huh.
And the Merry Wives of Windsor, she actually commissioned that, didn't she? She said she wanted a play about the fat knight.
Yes, that's right.
Falstaff,
corrupter of youth.
Yeah, and so Shakespeare sat down and wrote that one.
Yeah. So does your series end with the Marlowe one or is
no,
one or more?
That's number 3.
Okay, well let's hear about the others.
I will do one on Will Kemp, the jester. He was.
Now you've experienced this firsthand, haven't you? Haven't you danced to?
I became him. Yeah.
Go on, tell the story.
The 9 Days Wonder, it's called. Well, yeah. Will Kemp and Shakespeare fell out in 1599. They had a row, and Kemp quit, threw in the towel, and abandoned the company. And what would he do with himself? He had a bet going that he could dance to Norwich. Norwich, which incidentally is where I was a student, but Norwich at the time was England's second city. So London and then Norwich. Norwich was a great centre of industry and commerce. Partly because it's quite close to Europe. You could, ships would sail from the Norfolk coast across to Holland.
You just went silent, Rick.
Now, a lot of them have very big customs houses in what appear to be just small towns and villages. So, you know, this, it's a legacy from a time when this was a wealthy part of the country. Now it's quite rural. Norfolk went sort of backwards in the, at the time of the Industrial Revolution. And Norwich became a minor city where once it had been the place. But anyway, it's, that was the destination. Will Kemp said, I can dance to Norwich and I'll do it in 9 days. And there were bets. It became a great sort of, you know, one of the gambles of the time. And the first bet was that he wouldn't get past Mile End. He'd be he'd be finished out of it by then.
Yeah.
It would end at Mile End, but he completed the task. It's not 9 days in a row. It was 9 individual days dancing. He did it through. He did it through Lent in 1599. So it took him about 3 or 4 weeks to do, with so days rest in between.
You've
so
duplicated
each day
this.
Of dancing was fanfared in advance. When I did it, I was rather more tied to time, as we all are nowadays. You know, you have to get back to work. So I had I did it continuously. I did 9 days on the stretch. And although I confess I didn't, I danced whenever traffic was passing, so it always looked as if I was dancing. And that was the you know, the record. But basically I walked and danced. I was taught a dance by the Morris men of Blackfriars. Left, right, left, hop, right, left, right, hop. It worked. And I carried two handkerchiefs. It's on my website. It's the picture of me sort of dancing there. And so that's how I did it, you know, all the way from London to Norwich.
Are you so far the first and only person who's duplicated Kemp's feat then?
There have been others. I have done, there was a Morris one, so they did it in costume. I can't think what I could say about mine that was unique. What I did, which was quite amusing, was I did it first, really, 9 days of dancing, and then at the when I arrived in Norwich, I came back to London. I hired a costume from the National Theatre. I had worn a costume to do it in. But it's my own costume and it's a bit tatty. So I hired a smart one from the National Theatre, you know, cost £100. And then I did it in reverse with a photographer. So I did it for a piece in the magazine, the BBC Music magazine. But as we did it in reverse, the beard that I'd grown doing it properly over 2 weeks, I then shaved off backwards. So I had the impression of passing time in the state of this beard. Is it, do you see what I mean? We came back. So the photographer met me in Norwich at the end of the walk, as it were, and he photographed the entire 9-day wonder in reverse in one day, going from venue to venue on by car. So I actually walked it, and then came back, did it again in reverse in a car. And when I had done it, I had arranged with people on the way, look, I'll be doing this again next week. Can we take pictures here? And so a school agreed. I've got these kids on the pavement waving and cheering Will Camp as he dances past. I'd, you know, set them up in advance the week before when I'd gone through. So it was quite well done, I have to say, in the event.
And you did it in costume, is that right? I mean, that sort of 16th century costume.
Both the actual event and the photographed. Yes, they are. It's in all in costume. And the other thing I did, I directly imitated Will Kemp in this. When he, the day before he was to arrive in Norwich, he went in incognito into Norwich on a horse. He didn't dance. And he did that in order to set up the publicity in advance. So he went into Norwich and started to spread the word. Will Kemp's coming. He's on his way. He'll be arriving in 2 days' time.
So he was known
in Norwich. He got the publicity machine going. And I did the same thing, in a sense. I also managed to arrange a horse for me. And the final picture of me going into Norwich is on a horse, which is the bit of William Kemp going in on a horse rather than dancing in. And then I danced in as well with the traffic. It was a good event.
Then
the mayor met me too, the mayor of Norwich, on the steps of the town hall, and she did a little dance with me, all for the cameras. I'll show you the pictures at some point. Well, I'll use the pictures when I do the virtual tour in 3 weeks' time on that one.
All of this is, of course, reminding me why we wanted you on the London Walks team.
Well, I'm very proud to be a part of the London Walks setup.
Let me ask you, what was the reaction of the motorists? I mean, did you cause any accidents?
I was nearly arrested.
Oh, yes.
Somebody had reported me. And mostly people would hoot or wave or you know, obviously some people got, you know, worried maybe, who is this person? And there was one day I was going along and I heard a police siren and I thought, I know, I know what that's going to be. And sure enough, this siren got closer and then it drew up behind me and I looked around and there were two policemen coming towards me. And they said, we've had a report that there's someone, you know, dancing along the motorway. A man in a costume. And we think we're going to be having... We thought we were going to have to be making an arrest of someone who'd escaped from a mental hospital. What they said. And when they, you know, I was able to explain and tell them what I was doing, and they were allayed. They were pacified by my reasoned argument as to what I was about.
Of course.
But
an eminently sensible thing.
Enough consternation, this dance, for them to send out a patrol car to investigate.
I did get
a picture of them, I'm pleased to say. I said, would you mind? And they said, not at all. And it exactly corresponds to an almost identical picture taken of me in Germany, because I did the same thing in Germany as J.S. Bach. It was another journalistic exercise before. It was a piece I wrote. And I imitated Johann Sebastian Bach. He did a walk of 250 miles from Arnstadt near the Czech border to Lübeck in the north of Germany. And this was in 2005. 200 years after J.S. Bach had done it. So I recreated that. That was the first one, actually, of what I began to call costume journalism. So I'd dress up and recreate a walk. Will Kemp was number six along the routine. But this, yeah, and the same thing happened. A police car siren blaring came along, and they said, "We're going to take you to a safer place." Because then I was actually on a motorway, and they said, "We're going to remove you."
So the safer place wasn't the local lunatic asylum.
No, it was a different road they wanted to put me on.
Excellent.
And I said, fair enough, as long as I can have a picture. And so I took a picture of them with me. And I've got these two pictures almost exactly the same. A police car, two policemen, but one's German and one's English.
Yeah.
And me.
Yeah. Rick, what's the date again for the Will Kemp one?
I can't remember. I think it's number 3 or 4 along the list.
Right.
But I'll confirm it.
I'm wondering, and you'll have 3 or 4 after that, is that right?
Yeah. There's others to follow.
Yeah.
There's Nell Gwynn. We've done enough. Do you want me to... Shakespeare to Nell Gwynn is very interesting.
I was just going to ask you if you would be willing to come back here, so to speak.
Yeah.
In a week or two.
Yes.
And we could have another session talking about, because we've gone on for nearly 50 minutes now.
Yeah.
And I'd rather not have you skimp on those. So could we do this again in a week or two?
I'd love to do it as a tour again. I'd love to take people on that trip.
Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Yeah, you could do it in a day.
All right. We can talk about that, and we can put that up, and maybe we'll get some takers for that. I mean, that would be a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I find that very interesting what you mentioned about Norwich being the second city, because that speaks to this country's orientation to Europe, and then of course it becomes Bristol, doesn't it?
Yes.
And that speaks again of the compass moving.
Exactly.
Because of the New World. All of that is fascinating. But I also want to ask you, and let's do this in the next session, you are the only guide who's able to guide in blank verse that you write. And so that's something that our hearers, our listeners are going to want to know about. So I'll be sure to... Go ahead.
Okay. We'll talk about that then, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, this has just been fantastic. Thanks so much, and I'll certainly be there on all of these. I'll be in the audience on all of these Shakespeare ones. And
okay.
We'll be in touch. But thanks a lot, Rick. This has been great.
No, well, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's great to talk to you, David. And I'm privileged. I'm proud to be doing things for London Walks. It's a great institution. It's been around for many years, and you started it, didn't you?
I didn't start it. It was started by an Australian.
Okay.
I was a schoolboy in Wisconsin when it was started.
So it does go back a long, long time. And you don't go back so long, but you've made it into something that's quite a feature of the London tourist landscape.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I've been involved with it for over 40 years.
So. 40 years? Oh.
Yeah. But London Walks have been going for over half a century.
Okay. Have they?
Yeah. Well. So... Anyway.
All right. Thank you, David. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Okay. Speak soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah. All best.
Bye.